at the request of John Paul II, a beautiful homily in which he talked about Giussani having been raised in a family poor in material goods but rich in beauty. Apparently they were very musical, and that always appealed to Ratzinger. So I think he's very bullish on Giussani. This pontificate does not seem to have quite as intimate a relationship with the movements as its predecessor, but this Pope conducts his life in a different way than his predecessor, but surely he had an enormous respect for Monsignor Giussani. Looking at Benedict's personal predilection to causing upset, could that be of his part of his approach to the response rate to the current revelations and even older ones of sexual abuse? I'm not entirely sure what that means, or perhaps it meant personal indisposition to causing upset. I think one of the factors with some of our bishops, with men of the present Pope's generation, is that it took them some time to wrap their heads around the fact that people could do stuff like this. I mean, I think there was just a genuine unwillingness to imagine that people could so betray the gift of the priesthood as to abuse young people. Now, I don't know whether that's true with Ratzinger or not, but it was certainly true that the canon law of 83, which was written deliberately to protect priests from overbearing bishops, and which bent over backwards to make it difficult for bishops to whack their presbyters, was another part of the problem. And as I think he became more and more aware of the magnitude of this in the late 90s, he was, as I indicated before, at the forefront in moving this out of the competence of the Congregation for Clergy and into the competence of CDEF. But I don't think one can underestimate this generational problem. And this is not something I would ever talk about publicly. It's something very difficult to explain in the current media climate. It was difficult to explain 8 years ago, but I think it's really part of the problem. I mean, there was a generation that was in authority in the church in 2002 that just found it extremely difficult to imagine that people could behave this way. Now, an additional factor with John Paul II, which I discussed in The Courage to be Careful, and discussed as well, and discuss as well in this second volume of the biography, which of course covers the 2002 business, is that charges of sexual impropriety were a standard feature of communist secret police attempts to get Catholic priests who were causing them trouble. I mean, this was just a standard part of the MO. Including all the, I mean, honey traps of various sorts. And when they couldn't get a guy to misbehave, they would just lie to him. So, I mean, he had this built-in instinct, you know, that I want to see real evidence here, because he'd been through this so many times. One of the delicious things in this new book, which, as I think I mentioned yesterday, Roger may have mentioned, explores Wojtyla versus communism, again, through the prism of some remarkable documentation I have gotten out of old Russian, Polish, East German, Hungarian, and other secret police files through the help of Polish historians, is that prior to the 1983 papal visit to Poland, second, during the martial law period, the SB, the Polish version of the KGB, tried to blackmail, set up a blackmail scam against Pope by concocting a diary of a woman who had died several years before, had in fact worked for the Archdiocese of Krakow in the 1960s, and according to this fake diary, was claiming in the diary that Wojtyla was her lover. And they were going to plant this in a priest's apartment and then discover it and then see if they could use this as leverage against what they were terribly afraid was going to be, you know, the Pope dropping the hammer on Jaruzelski, etc. The guy in charge of this operation planted the diary in the apartment of an old Cracovian priest, a great guy named Andrzej Barzewski, and then was so pleased with himself that he went out with three of his colleagues, got roaring drunk, crashed his car that night, and was arrested by the police. And in order to get himself out of this mess, he started bragging about being in this special section of the SB, dealing with the church and what he had just done. So the story leaks out that way, that they have tried to create this blackmail scam against the Pope. So that's, by the way, that was the same priest who murdered Father Pope Bushman. 2 years later,
The priest murdered?
No, this is the same SB guy who murdered Father. See, I told you I'm tired.
Okay.
So that's part of the background to all of that. I feel like Carnap the Magnificent. Could share any additional anecdotal experiences of JP2, even perhaps Benedict 16th, everyday types of things, such as dietary preferences, routine recreational activities, moments during JP2's final days, B16's first table moments, badoo, badoo, badoo. Dietary preferences. John Paul II had deplorable taste in food. These dear sweet sisters, Tobiana and all the rest of them, you really do not want Polish nuns pretending to cook Italian food. Not a good idea. And the thing to try to do when you were over there trying to get FaceTime was to maneuver your way into Wednesday lunch, because Wednesday was Nun's Day off. And Angelo Gugio, the valet, this tall, striking, silver-haired guy, always wore a black suit and tie, Angelo knows the kitchen. And so you would actually get something worth eating on Angelo. But I remember one night driving down from Scarpone, which I'm sure many of you know in Rome, late at night with then Monsignor, now Archbishop Jim Harvey. And we had gotten up there late, and we were up there late. It was slightly after midnight, and we were coming back down the Giunicolo. And the lights were on in the apartment, the paper apartment. It was late for that. And Jim said, gee, I wonder what's going on. I said, well, it's midnight Tuesday going on Wednesday. The nuns have got to start cooking Friday's vegetables. JP2 had a great sweet tooth, liked his dolce. So that continued to the S. I think his recreation, aside from the exercise that we talked about yesterday, he was very serious about it, so the body just wouldn't let him do it, was reading. I mean, he was not a musical person. He had zero taste in visual arts. I mean, some of those crazy chassis. But this goes back a long way. One of his oldest friends is still alive, a very distinguished art historian in Poland, named Jacek Wojciechowski, who was the first post-communist or after communism, Lord Mayer of Krakow, and he's a friend, and his son is one of my Polish publishers. But Jacek told me that he went into Wojtyła's room while he was writing the Schaller habilitation thesis, and said that the first words out of my mouth were, "Why do you have such an ugly picture on your wall?" And he hadn't even sort of realized it was there. I mean, visual art and music were just not part of the thing. He, with the exception of these picture books that I talked about yesterday, which I really do think fired his imagination poetically. But what he did in the evening, when he would allow himself time to relax, was read. And as I say in the new book and have said on the stump innumerable times, he is undoubtedly the only man in human history who read the French philosopher Emmanuel Levinas for fun. I mean, if any of you have ever tried to read Levinas, it's not. But that was his recreation. There's another interesting facet of his daily routine that I'm describing in some detail in the new book. The Holy See was rather badly penetrated by East Bloc intelligence services from the time of the Second Vatican Council on. And I think those living in communist countries either knew that or suspected.
You said those living in communist
countries? Like Vyshinsky, Wojtyła, whatnot. They thought the place was a sieve and that it had no counterintelligence capability. So when Wojtyła got there, he changed a part of the routine in an interesting way. I should back this story up by saying when I first went out to Castle Gandolfo in September 96 to have the first real working session towards Witness to Hope, I had 4 pages of stuff that I said, we've got to get through this over the next 2 years. Boom, boom, boom. Questions, documents, whatever. So we started going through that, and I had asked him for a memoranda of conversations that he would have dictated after meeting with X, Y, and Z. I remember one of them was Andrei Kubik, the old war horse Soviet foreign minister. And that night he said to me, I don't do this. Okay, fine, so check that off the list. Then 2.5 years later, I'm back up in the apartment for dinner, and this is the absolute last minute. We're correcting proofs, and there were a couple of things that I wanted to nail that I thought other people had gotten wrong. And one of them was a report in that rather dreadful book by Carl Bernstein and Marco Politi, in which they suggested that the Pope had met with the Soviet ambassador to Italy during the martial law period to cut a deal behind the backs of the imprisoned Solidarity people and end the martial law. And this sounded wholly implausible to me, but I wanted to be able to nail it. So that night I had these 2 or 3 things, and I said one of them was, I said, the Holy Father, did you meet with the Soviet ambassador to Italy on, I forget what the hell the date was, April something, 1980. And he looked at me and he said, I don't think I ever met with the Soviet ambassador. And he turns to Jivish and he says, Stasha, did I ever meet with the Soviet ambassador in Italy? And he says, I don't think so. But wait. Jivish leaves the room, goes back into the private part, comes back with this leather diary, you know, date calendar. He said, what'd you say the date was? Say it was April 15th. It's April 15th, 1982. Nope. Let's look a few days before. Nope. Let's look a few days after. Nope. No such meeting. I said, good. I'm glad we got that straightened out. I said, by the way, what's that? And he said, oh, I have one of these for every month of the pontificate. they were, see, the archives of the present pope are not in the secret archives. They're in the Secretary of State. So they're readily accessible. If somebody wants to, you know, what's the policy on Botswana? You know, you can go over and get this quickly without rooting through the historical records. I think they were convinced that there were people who should not have access to stuff in the Secretary of State who were getting access. So there are no memoranda of conversations that would have been filed. But every night, he and Stanislav sat down for a half an hour and went through the deck. This is who we met, these are the main points of conversation, etc. On the formal schedule, and, you know, people like me, on the non-stuff that doesn't get into Nostra Aetate in Osservatore Romano. All that stuff is now up in Krakow. It's going to provide for somebody someday the most detailed record of a pontificate, I think it's ever been assembled. But the reason they did that was that they knew the place had untrustworthy people, or untrustworthy people working for even more untrustworthy people. And they weren't going to have this leak. So that's an interesting facet of the new one, too. The only thing I can say, Ernie, about the B-16 routine is that you can set your watch on. You want to know exactly when it's 4:30 in the afternoon, the car pulls into the Cortile San Damaso, he gets in, they drive to the gardens, he walks for a half an hour. At the stroke of 5 o'clock, you know, he's back in the Cortile and going up to the Terza Loggia. 33 minutes a day for piano. Precisely. This is the Teutonic model. You would think the recent creation of the corporate home for Anglican Converts to Catholicism spells the end of clerical celibacy, especially in England, where reconciled Anglicans like to constitute the majority of Catholic clergy. The short answer to that is no, because the only pass on celibacy has been given for this generation of Anglican clergy and those present in formation. They're grandfathered in, and then that's it. And that was made clear by these implementing laws. So no, that's not anything.
That's two questions. In fairness to the others, you've answered one. I appreciate it.
Okay. Mention the reluctance of the local bishops to govern vis-a-vis dissenters, parole boards, etc. Might they not say they were following the lead of the Holy See since John 23rd, as to the mercy speech, e.g. Cardinal O'Boyle left hanging by Paul VI after Humana Vitae, Coleman declared not a Catholic theologian, but not suspended, excommunicated on the Catholic parole boards. I think these are somewhat different situations. I think the 68 business was a big, big problem. And I have a 4 or 5 page discussion of that in The Courage to be Catholic, in which I talk about the effects of what I called in there the truce of 1968. On everything, including the kind of genetic code transmitted with Episcopal ordination about, you know, how far out on the limb can you get, and will the Holy See then sometimes saw the limb off by. This was a real problem. This was a real problem. I've actually never talked about this with Archbishop Worrell, because he and John Donohue, the Emeritus Archbishop of Atlanta, a wonderful guy, they were the two go-betweens between Cardinal Wright, who Worrell was his secretary, and he was head of clergy, and O'Boyle, Paddy O'Boyle, and I guess John Donohue was vicar general or chancellor or something in Washington. So these two guys who themselves became major figures in the American hierarchy, you know, were the ones who were carrying the messages between the principals. Paul VI was desperately afraid of Susan. This is, I think, the fundamental fact of 68, which perhaps explains why there is no encyclical in the pontificate after 68, because that's how they're called by the reaction. He was very, very afraid of schism, particularly in the United States. Now, this would have, I mean, I think anyone with any sense would have told him that would go nowhere. That would go nowhere. I mean, people might try it, but it's not going to get it. But that was a deep, deep concern of his. And I think that's why he wanted a solution to the Washington case that was as generous as you could be without completely abandoning the authority of the magisterium. But the signal that sent to an entire generation of bishops was, if you attempt to make priests toe the line, and this goes public, you know, there's not a lot of backup. And that was a huge problem. That was a huge problem. I don't know that there was any necessity to excommunicate or suspend Kerr. He very quickly faded from the scene once he lost the position of somebody authorized by the church to teach Catholic theology. It's encouraged to be Catholic, but I also refer to the Charles Davis principle of dissent. Anybody who's old enough here to remember Charles Davis? No, right, man. Mary, what's going on here? Really old times. Charles Davis, for you children present, was the Dick McBrien of England, a second or third tier theologian who had written a couple of mildly interesting books, who was a big television media guy during that time. And Davis, in the wake of Humanae Vitae, publicly announced that he was leaving the church and going to the Anglicans, at which point everybody lost interest in him completely, because Anglican criticizes Catholic Church is not a story. Catholic priest criticizes Catholic Church is a story. Because that's, you know, man bites dog. I believe that every one of these characters since Charles Davis learned the lesson that you have to stay formally in the institution if you want any kind of leverage in the public culture. So you get this situation, which I've described elsewhere, as de facto or psychological system, but they're not going to go into full system. Nobody would pay the slightest bit of attention to Dick McBrien over the last 20 years if he had become a Methodist preacher. I mean, zero. No attention whatsoever. But Father Richard McBrien, chairman of the theology department of Notre Dame, that's his pope. You know, that's man bites dog. So I think that's, you know, part of the dynamics. What qualities, characteristics would you like to see in U.S. diocesan bishops? Balls.
To use a theological term.
Anthropological term. Moving up from there. I describe in The Courage to be Catholic a whole new set of criteria for the reform set of criteria for the selection of diocesan bishops, primarily having to do with evangelical success. And this is a guy who demonstrably can preach the gospel, attract people to it, gets vocations, parishes lively liturgically, there's a devotional life,
he can explain the doctrine of the church publicly in a compelling way. He's not gun-shy of the media. He's willing to have fights, but he doesn't go looking for fights. This is all there. It's waiting for some nuncio to pick up and effect. But I would refer anybody who's interested in that to that well, somebody's cheating and put five things on. Let's just take one because it's the top one here. What about the Legionaries of Christ? Some of you may have seen the piece I wrote a year ago called Saving What Can Be Saved. I will probably write a one-year-later type piece, maybe late this month, early next, when the visitations are complete. I have come to the view that the only way to save what can and should be saved is to dissolve the present structure, preferably by their dissolving it themselves in the general congregation. And then under the supervision of the Holy See, creating a process by which those who would like to re-found a community dedicated to orthodoxy, high school and college work, I mean, whatever they would define the charism. And then those who wanted to join that would have to go through a vetting process, which would have the effect of allowing you to weed out people who had been determined to be complicit or worse enablers of Maciel's perfidy. I think the reason that is necessary is that while the letter of 2 weeks ago, or 3 weeks ago, whenever it was, from the legionary leadership to the members of the congregation and to Radio Christi, threw Maciel under the bus, there is still an enormous psychological, some would say psychopathological, investment in what you might call the grand narrative of legionary history built around him that I think can only be broken by a corporate acceptance. I don't think even with the most gifted, tough-minded, apostolic delegate imposed on this structure, which I'm afraid is the solution, I don't think that works. I think there has to be, and there has to be seen to be, has to be seen to be a clean break with this text. But whether that's a notion that can be sold, I don't know. But I think that's what's necessary in order to make the break that seems to be required.
Would that also apply to Runyon Christi, George?
I haven't really thought that part of it through, Roger, to tell you the truth. I am very concerned about what's going on in some of these Reagan Christian schools. I mean, I was known to be, and still am, a friend of numerous legionary priests. Jason Berry keeps saying I was big on Maciel. I met Maciel 3 times, didn't like him any of those times, but didn't see any point in saying, you know, why does this guy use orange hair dye? You know, it makes me nervous. What the hell is the point of saying that? I think because I was known to be a friend of a lot of these guys, there was a very strong reaction against what I wrote last January in some parts of that world. But it also brought a lot of parents out of the woodwork who were writing me from all over the place, talking about what their concern is real coercion of conscience in some of these schools. And I have put all of them in touch with the appropriate people, both diocesan laws and elsewhere. And while the mandate of the visitation did not touch Redding Christi, the fact that some of this pressure on 14 is coming from legionary priests suggests to me that that's within the mandate of the visitation. So I suggested to several of these people in the more egregious cases when there was a priest involved that they get in touch with Archbishop Chabot. Okay. Do you feel B16 supports the moniker JP2 the Great? I have no idea. This is not a formal title bestowed by the church, as you all know. It's something that emerges over time. Those of us who were there in the square, or above the square, in my case, on April 8th, think that the people of the church gave him that title that day. Whether that sticks is something we'll leave to history to determine, and I have no idea what the present Pope thinks about that. We argued in that one. The effects John Paul II has had on Protestants and what V16 will bring to ecumenical efforts. Well, I think we talked about that a bit last night and today. The biggest ecumenical surprise of JP2 was the enormous response from fundamentalists, evangelical, Pentecostal Protestants, particularly in the U.S. And that has created a whole new set of conversations that were not conceivable 30 years ago. Many of you, I'm sure, are familiar with the Evangelicals and Catholics Together project that's affiliated with First Things. I mean, if anybody had said to me when we started that 15 years ago, when the whole focus was kind of co-belligerency and the culture war, it wasn't theology, that we would have produced joint statements on the communion of saints and Mary's role in the church, or that one of the leading Baptist theologians of America, Timothy George, is writing a book on why Protestants need to take Mary seriously. I mean, I would have said, you're nuts, but, you know, that's what's come out of this. Now, it's very interesting that this has all been informal. None of this, you know, goes through the usual grooves of bureaucratically ordered ecumenical dialogue, and at some point it'll have to, you know, enter the more formal structures of the church. But for the moment, I would say that's the single biggest surprise to emerge out of this. And the reason for it is obvious. It's what I said yesterday. I mean, these people recognize in JP2 an unapologetic disciple who was an unapologetic preacher of the truth of God in Christ. And, you know, just put that out there in a very direct and compelling way. What Benedict will bring to ecumenical efforts, I think the stress will be more on orthodoxy and trying to make some sort of advance in that very difficult world. But I think everybody, probably from Cardinal Casper on down, knows that the trajectory of the old bilaterals, RCIC, Catholic Lutheran, Catholic Reform, Catholic Methodist, etc. I mean, the arc of that has been completed. And it's not been completed with what people had hoped it would eventually. But it's not really going anywhere dramatically in the future. Because from our point of view, there's increasingly less of a there to talk because of the chaos theologically in those worlds. I do think, I mean, here's another possibility, whether this is professional ecumenism, not regarding this as falling under the rubric of ecumenism. But I think it's entirely possible that before too long, there will be something like the old pastoral provision for Anglicans, for Lutherans. The ELCA is coming apart at the seams. The confessionally serious Lutheran clergy remaining are frankly much better trained theologically, homiletically, and otherwise than most Catholic priests. They're completely orthodox. They think of themselves as members of the Una Sancta. They don't have this kind of Protestant cast in mind. And several of them have, of course, come into the church and are functioning as priests, Richard Newhouse most famously, Leonard Klein in Wilmington, who's married. Philip Johnson has just been ordained a deacon in Camden and will be ordained a priest later. But I think there's probably several dozen of those guys out there, and they would be great recruits to our side. So I think there might be something along those lines. Here's another multiple choice question. Significant challenges for Catholicism in 21st century America. Well, I suppose that depends on how you read the meaning of the last 2 weeks and whether that has shifted our situation in a dramatic way. And I think it's probably too early to say on that. And I don't mean that in the Jolyn Lye French Revolution sense that it's too early to say. I mean, maybe see where we are, you know, by the summer and the fall, and whether we really are in a situation where the American media and most of the high culture has declared war. Now, if that's the case, then that creates a certain set of imperatives. If we were to go back, if I were to have been asked this question 4 months ago, I would have said, among other things, that perhaps the biggest pastoral challenge for the church in 21st century America is high school. I think we're doing better with elementary school level catechesis. We're getting some colleges back. We know the ones that are lost for good. There's a lot of vibrant stuff going on in campus ministries and state university campuses and private schools, but I don't think anybody in the Catholic Church knows what to do. I just don't think we know how to deal with it. And that's where the leak in body comes. I think the answer to that must have something to do with creating at least a simulacrum of a Catholic culture for these kids to live. I mean, it can't just be catechetics and the intellectual side. They have to know that the church is a culture. It has an aesthetic, it has music, it has art, it has a way of life, it has a way of relating to other people. And we might want to look at some of these more successful evangelical program, teen life and stuff like that. I mean, it's a wholly different aesthetic, so we can't just copy that. But try to figure out what are the dynamics that let them, or the Mormons, you know, who seem enormously capable of hanging on to it. Why? Because they're in a Mormon world, even when they're not living in Salt Lake City, Provo, or wherever. So that's certainly one, it seems to me, a real biggie. And since we haven't talked about that, I'll mention that. Right. Comment on the ongoing investigation of women religious in the U.S.
Bryant's column concerning Senator Sanders.
Well, we'll see. My frank comment on that would be it's 30 years too late. The horse is so far, or the mayor is so far out of form at this point that there's just no getting them back in. Silly would be the wrong image, I said, given the age. The next big, huge mess in this is going to be property. Where was I? I was at Providence, when I was at Providence College, talking to some of the younger Dominicans there while watching Georgetown lose in the first round of the NCAAs, which was bringing great glee to Dominican hearts. One of these guys mentioned that he had heard, presumably from inside the Cincinnati Dominicans, that they have a plan for giving away the property before the last Cincinnati Dominican turns out the lights, and that none of it is going to Catholic institutions. So I informed several members of the hierarchy with Cincinnati Dominican connections that they might want to give Mother President, or whatever her name is, a call and say, what's shaking? But that's a huge mess. I mean, this is going to be, as these communities, which are the principal focus of this study, and let's not kid ourselves about that, die, which they are manifestly doing. The question of what happens to what is literally billions of dollars worth of assets in every conceivable form, liquid assets, real estate, institutions, everything, and whether we're going to end up in some horrible, endless legal mess fighting over donor intent and all the rest of that, I don't know. But it's, look, we know what works in religious life under these circumstances. What works is the Alba Mercies, National Dominicans, et cetera, et cetera. What doesn't work is social workers just by Martin Taylor. It just doesn't work. This doesn't work. And there's no reason for it to work. But what is, the idea that some intervention from the Congregation for Religions 30 years today is going to have, it might be somewhat encouraging to these poor old gals who I really feel sorry for, who are dying surrounded by people they regard as heretics. It might be some consolation to them. But in, at the real world of this, I don't see what the turnaround is. And the next set of big problems are not going to be, goofball nuns getting up at LCWR conventions and talking in a post-deist world or a post-theist world, it's going to be problem. It's going to be a lot of... Now, this obviously has a huge effect on the Catholic Health Association question, Catholic health care in the U.S. My colleague Jim Capretta, who has done some of the best work on a real health care that I know, Jim told me he worked for, and Jim has been in the Office of Management and Budget, he's worked in the White House, he's a very serious guy, very solid guy. I think he has affiliations to Open Stay in some respect. His brother-in-law is Charlie Brett, at CEO. His wife is Charlie's sister. And Jim told me months ago, he had worked for CHA for 3 months. And the atmosphere was so poisonously anti-magisterial that he simply couldn't stay. So he was the last guy surprised when dear sister Carol Keaton decided that she was the magisterial for purposes of health care policy. So that's not a pretty picture.
rededication homily at Monte Cassino. Keeps many titles on Benedict, Father of Europe, Bringer of Peace, etc. Is this why Benedict chose his name? Well, he's said why he chose the name. He thinks it's euphonious. He likes the settings of the Benedictus in the great musical tradition of the church. He wanted to lift up the image of Benedict, the father of Europe, as we know it. And I think he's a great admirer of Benedict the 15th, who, in my view, is the most underrated pope of the 20th century. A genuinely terrific pope, who only lasted a little over 7 years. Is that right? Yeah, 1914, 1922. Elected in like August 1914 and died early 1922. So I think the, you know, that's what he said he took the name for, and I'll take him at his word. What one or two teachings of John Paul II do you think would be most important for us as priests to embody and or pass on to the faithful? John Paul II made the adventure of Christian discipleship exciting, compelling, even fun. And we need to be able, all of us, you and your vocations and me and mine, to do that. That this is, in fact, the most interesting and exciting offer available in the world. The dynamic orthodoxy is more interesting, more engaging, more compelling account of the human condition than anything else that's out there. And that's, you know, the more we say that, the more attractive we are as a community, and as individuals who are all called by virtue of our baptism to be, to exercise the Great Commission, to live out the Great Commission in some fashion or another. So I think that's something I would lift up. There's nothing more exciting than Catholic faith. Then I mentioned yesterday in discussing the Pope's sense of late Pope's sense of paternity, you know, to be able to say to young people, don't ever, ever settle for anything less than the spiritual and moral grandeur that God's grace makes possible. That doesn't mean you're not going to screw up. You are going to screw up. We all screw up. The thing to do when you screw up is not to lower the bar of expectation. I mean, that's, a, I think that's, kids want to be challenged to lead lives. And that's a pretty compelling challenge. Could I speak to the spirituality of the new translations of the Roman Missal and how effective pastorally to introduce it in a parish setting? Well, I haven't seen a lot of the new stuff, to be perfect. I saw some bootleg copies, green books, purple books, and yellow books, and whatnot. So I can't really address that. I would, if I were a parish pastor, I would make the occasion of this shift, which alas is now, somewhat, one of you guys told me, is now like fall 2011.
Right.
So we're going to have another Lent of informing God in the collect of what God already knows, and then making some anodyne request to make us nice people who suffer in Jesus. Not looking forward to that. I would make this transition. I would say even beginning with maybe Pentecost 2011 until Advent 2011, the occasion for a thorough recatechesis, or in some cases, catechesis of the parish in the meaning of the church's worship. What the heck are we doing? And why are we doing it? And then the language, if that's done right, then this more sacral language will just flow naturally from it. In terms of materials, the only thing I've seen was given me by Andrew Wadsworth, the new head of ISIL, when we had a Getting to Know You lunch a couple of months ago. It's a pack of materials from LTP in Chicago, Liturgical Training Publications, which Cardinal George has completely cleaned out. I mean, that's been de-Bolshevized, and there are real Catholics back in charge. I thought they were a little apologetic in the wrong sense of the term, a little too aware of the criticisms and trying to bend over backwards to meet them. But, you know, you might want to look at those if you want pamphlet rack stuff or bulletin and such. But I would look at this as an enormous occasion to do what was never done properly in most places 35 years, 40 years ago. And that is a thorough catechesis of the nature of the liturgy, the structure of the liturgy, the why of worship, this whole idea of our participation in the liturgy of angels and saints. This is our privilege pipeline into the divine liturgy, if you all of that sort of thing. I mean, that's just daylight to run to. It seems. Is there any reason why B16 has not chosen a papal motto, especially for Master of Synthesis? Well, there's no motto on the coat of arms, but then there really wasn't on JP2's either. And everybody knew it was Totus Tuus. Or at least there weren't on some representations of it. I had just assumed that he had kept Cooperatores Veritatis as from his Munich business. There's a hilarious story about the present Pope's coat of arms. Those of you who have been back behind the big top in the Magic Kingdom know that there is this, before you get to the Gubernatorato, there's this big floral display of the Pope's coat of arms. And Raymond D'Souza, the smartest young priest in the country, was over helping Marianne Glendon at the Pontifical Council for the Social Sciences meeting, which Marianne was the chairman of. Raymond was helping do some press work and whatnot. So one day he's, while they're on a break, they meet in the casino, was Pio Quarto. Mm-hmm. So Raymond's taking a little walk, and the gardener is trimming the now B16, that very busy coat of arms. And so Raymond has pretty good Italian and says to the guy, well, you know, how do you like this coat of arms? The guy in classic Italian, pardon me, says, it was a lot easier with the old popes. We've got a real problem with these big black lips. Good, Raymond. We'll put that in the column, please. Thank you very much. That was the gardener's thing. Right. Is the move to canonize John Paul II too hasty? As a general proposition, I think the rush to canonize popes is a bad idea. I do think one needs to be able to digest a pontificate. I was never frankly, I mean, Pius IX was undoubtedly a man of heroic virtue. I was frankly not persuaded by my man's homily at his beatification when he says that the church does not canonize or beatify a man's judgments, but this is a reflection on his character and Christian sense. Well, that's obviously true. But having been an official witness for the beatification of JP2, I know that one of the questions asked is about the exercise of the virtue of prudence. Now, that's an interesting way to think of it. This whole, I don't think I violated secrets,
by saying the way, at least the questionnaire for JP2 was set up, is there are 132 questions. Half of them were biographical. And I said to my senior editor, the postulator, I said, do I really have to answer that? He said, just put that in the page numbers in your book. Your book is the Bible in this office. But the second half is organized around virtues. So there are 20 questions or so on theological virtues, 20 questions or so on cardinal virtues, and then a section called other virtues. And that was a very interesting exercise for me to rethink this life through the prism of those virtues. And specifically, the cardinal virtues. And what does it mean for folks to exercise the virtue of prudence in a heroic way? It can't mean you get everything right, because nobody gets everything right. I mean, no pope has gotten every prudential judgment right. This is not happening. So it must mean something about the quality of your decision making. Were you immune to untoward pressures? Did you take the time you needed to, you know, get it right, etc.? And I discuss all of this in the new book. But I do think that there has been a bit of a rush on all of this. Whether it's John the 23rd or Paul the 6th, or now there's a cause going for John Paul the 1st. Church lived for almost a half a millennium without canonizing between Pius the 5th and Pius the 10th. And now every pope of the 20th century, with the exception of Benedict the 15th, and Pius XI, there's a beatification, a canonization. Are suddenly we getting more heroic sanctity in the papacy? Have the criteria shifted in such a way? It looks a little peculiar. Now, it's going to sound like special pleading, but in the case of John Paul II, it was such a spontaneous affirmation from the people of the church at the time of his funeral, that I think, as with Mother Teresa, it was appropriate to initiate the cause when the present pope agreed to initiate. I was violently opposed to trying to jam this through for the 5th anniversary, because I thought that would give the enemies just another stick to be. I do think, just as a prudential matter, in terms of the reception of this, it is important that a very clear accounting of the whole Maciel affair be completed before this process is done, lest this become a stick. It's the only stick they've got to beat it, and they will use it. I believe that the Pope was very badly deceived by Maciel, but then a hell of a lot of other people were deceived by Maciel too, including members of his own religious community. And is that a disqualifying thing? I don't think so. But I think for the sake of the perception of the integrity of the process, this needs to be sequenced in such a way that, I mean, I do not, I've said this to Javish, who doesn't quite. But he's in the special church. I said, so I don't want the third paragraph in every news story in the whole wide blank world to be about Nazi. I mean, this is going to be too important a day for the church, for Poland, for whatnot. We don't want that to be part of the mix, and that therefore this sequence.
And I'll just leave that. My thoughts on the utility of military intervention and where it stands in the mind of church leaders. I think, and I have written on many occasions, that what used to be called Catholic International Relations Theory, the whole way of thinking about world politics, within which the just war way of thinking about use of armed force was framed, has fallen badly fallow in the last 4 years. And needs to be rather dramatically reformed. I've written about this in the book Against the Grain. If any of you are interested in that, I'll point you towards that. There are a whole new set of questions on the table now that were not imaginable 2 generations ago. The question of non-state actors and how they fit into the just war theory. The question of what, if any, is the moral authority as distinguished from the legal authority of the UN. What do we do with the fact that precision-guided munitions make it more likely rather than less that we can observe proportionality and discrimination in targeting? These are all very important questions that very few people are paying attention to. And because the tradition has been so poorly taught in seminaries and graduate schools of theology, it's kind of a mishmash today. And it serves us poorly because the church now has a kind of, how to put this, moral framing capacity. Moral framing of issues that it has never had before. I mean, the church has always claimed a kind of universal teacher of mankind, but it's never had the means to do that. Regensburg, whatever else it did, showed how a pope can put issues on the world agenda in a way nobody knows. JP2's defense of the universality of human rights at the UN in 1995, his suggestion, which has been picked up by Benedict in his own UN address, that the language of human rights, the idea of human rights, provides a kind of moral grammar by which the world, in the exercise of practical reason, can find a way to conduct an orderly conversation about the human future. Nobody else can do this. President can't do it. French president can't do it. Angela Merkel can't do it. God knows the UN Secretary General can't do it. Bill Gates can't do it. Bono can't do it. So we ought to be at the front end of helping people. Courage, boys, 3 to go. On a theoretical level, JPT was deeply concerned with various abuses of liturgy. From a practical level, was not in his interest in B16. Any thoughts on why? Well, you know, as I've tried to explain to innumerable reporters over the last 2 weeks on a different set of issues, the Catholic Church is not a high school, a global high school with a billion students. The Pope isn't the prefect of discipline. You know, you just cannot expect the Pope to fix every damn problem at the parish level on up in the church. That's point one. Point two is, and perhaps more serious, since I don't need to explain that to you, the Polish experience of the implementation of Sacrosanctum Concilium is wholly different than. They took their time. The translations are in a kind of high literary Polish that's still accessible to ordinary people. It's not, you know, C-spot, God, dear God, make us nice people through Jesus Christ the Lord. None of that. They've retained a lot of the tradition of the church's music while blending it with Polish materials. So his experience of all this from 70 to 78 was very, very different than the experience. Then I think there is the mystical side, and there was the mystical side. I mean, you all saw this for years. When he was at the altar, he was literally someplace else. I mean, he was just in another place. I mean, he was in that, what I refer to as the pipeline, so completely that he was literally on the other side of the pipeline. And in that sense, I mean, he was not, I think he wasn't aware of all this other stuff, but he had such a richly mystical experience of the Novus Ordo itself that it may have blunted sensibilities about some of the deformations. Third, and this would be the serious point with respect to what I said first, it's the local bishop's job to be the guy who enforces liturgical discipline in the diocese. It's not the Pope's job. One thinks one has heard all of the liturgical horror stories imaginable, but I get an email Good Friday night from Dana Joya, very distinguished poet, very serious Catholic, former head of the National Endowment for the Arts, going to get the Lectari Medal at Notre Dame this year, and people say some interesting stuff. It says, for my sins, I was subjected to Stations of the Cross in Sonoma, where he has a farm. The priest declined to show up. Four elderly ladies led the service. None of them could pronounce the words in the biblical citations correctly. But I thought, George, the one you would particularly enjoy is when Eloi, Eloi, Lama Sabachthani came out, Allah, Allah, Lama Sabachthani. Great moment to do it yourself literature. I think I told some of you guys at dinner, a year and a half ago, I was early for a meeting in the vicariate room. So I went into the basilica to have a quick prayer to say hi to Leo the 13th. And there, at the altar that's in the apse behind the main altar, in front of the cathedral, there is a pilgrimage group, I assume from Taiwan. They were all Chinese. The priest was sitting in the little presidential chair. And every one of these 80 pilgrims was coming up and helping themselves to communicate. And I'm looking and saying, who the hell's cathedral is this? Some guy named Ratzinger? What is going on? Now, you know, somebody should have said something around that time. But I mean, that's the degree of laissez-faire under which we live. This is always asked, reflection on how my time with these two great men has touched or shaped my own life. I like to often say, in response to that, I would be even worse than I am now, absent this. It's obviously given me an enormous affection for them. You can't spend time with human and Christian greatness without finding it lovely. That's a very touching thing, personally. Neither one of these men was a kind of huggy-kissy guy. It was only in the last years of our relationship that at the end of an encounter, J.P. Two would draw me into the embrace. They communicated a sense that, look, we've all got a job, we've all got a vocation, you know, but don't whine about it, get on with it. And I was telling Father Dave this great JP2 story that will be in the new book. There's a Polish actor named Jerzy Stur, who's actually the head of the Drama Academy in Krakow, a very distinguished guy. And about 20 years ago, he's in Rome. And Pope gets wind of this and invites him to dinner. Stur is very excited, goes to dinner, they sit down. Pope says, so, Pagliarzi, what brings you to Rome? He says, Holy Father, I'm playing in Forefathers Eve, played by Adam Mickiewicz, single most important drama in the history of Polish drama. It's like if you took all of Shakespeare, all of Ben Jonson, snippet of Tom Stoppard, and you know, put it together and show it. And this is a huge, sprawling, 4 or 5 hour thing. That is such an embodiment of Polish national consciousness that during the partitions of Poland between 1795 and 1918, the performance of it was banned in the Prussian and Russian occupied parts of Poland. So, Pope says, that's great, terribly important play, explains why it's important, and then says, so, Pagliarzi, what role do you play? And Stur says, Holy Father, I regret to report that I am Satan. And the Pope thinks about that for a minute and says, well, none of us can choose our roles, can we? And I think, you know, that's part of what I learned from J.P. Yeah, we just did that. Can I offer words to priests and how you can support the work of Benedict XVI? I think in the present moment, it's very important for the people of the church to know that there is not a crisis of sex abuse in the Catholic Church in the United States. That the problems that came to light in 2002 have been addressed. The fact that they have begun to be addressed 10 years that the church is the safest environment for children and young people in America, and that from the late 90s on, this Pope, in his previous incarnation and in his present one, has been absolutely determined to address what problems there remain and to do what he can to heal the remaining open wounds of past person. People need to hear that. You know, they can't just duck this and say, well, it's a damn paper. I think people need to hear that. And I think they will rally because they saw when he was here in the U.S. In that marvelous gesture, more than a gesture, I mean, a real pastoral outreach to people from this part. That he really gets on this stuff, and I think people need him to hear that. So that's
there's much. Documentation that's really good because people don't will not take just us saying it. They want to. They think that the press is more reliable than the church defending itself.
Kind of excellent minus 7. Dealing with here, believe the press.
No, but I mean, people have, if you're defending
the
yourself.
The mud sticks. I understand what you're saying. Roger and I can, in this bibliography we're going to put together, we put up a lot of stuff that I've written, that Ray D'Souza has written, that others have written, laying out, actually, Levada's. I mean, maybe they won't regard that as serious, but Levada's interview with the New York Times, in which you explained how Ratzinger and Ben died to get these 2001 norms in place, I think is very important. And, you know, just the background information on how this stuff works. The interview with Charles Ciccone in Avadere that was then translated into English, it goes through what's the process for dealing with the in a very lucid way. I mean, very, very. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you might want to have some of those available as kind of handouts to bring them and whatnot. But you should also remind them, and I say this as someone who occasionally commits journalism, mm-hmm. of that great line of the French poet Baudelaire, much may be learned from newspapers if they are read with the proper contempt. True in the 19th century and true today. It's been great to be with you guys. Thank you again for all that you do. And let's pray.
There's a snack down the way for anybody, 9:30 for evening prayer tonight. There's a slight change in the schedule tomorrow compared to today. It's on the schedule. It's on the schedule. But I think we meet 15 minutes earlier tomorrow at 7:15.
By the way, it just occurs to me, if any of you...